Are we there yet? Hey! I mean, I can yell, but this is better. Good morning. Welcome to church. My name's J.D. Winters. On the back of your bulletin is some information about me. That is not because we just fill the back of the bulletin with whoever's doing announcements. This is a little bit of info because I'm one of the pastors here on staff, and I am in the process of hopefully joining the elder board. And so just a little info about me. If you're a member here, if you have questions or concerns about that, there's info there on how to contact the elders and also the details about a meeting on the 24th to come to as part of that process. We got a lot of stuff going on. I'm tired just looking at all the things we have. I think I might just be tired because I was traveling this week, actually. But anyway, we want to make sure that you are taking a look at those things and you know what's going on. A couple weeks left to register for VBS. We've got an ambassador barbecue and potluck and game time coming up this week. There's a hymn sing in a couple of weeks on the 24th we want you to know about. We're having a potluck today after church. Hopefully you came prepared for that. You're going to hear from Tim and Clarissa Jones in our service today and get more information from them after service. So we invite you to stick around for that. But two things I do really want to highlight. The first one is on Saturday, we are having a men's breakfast downstairs, 7 a.m. It's free. We want to invite all the men to come. It's going to be a great time, not just to be together and have a great meal together, but also to hear about what we're doing in our men's ministries. We want to also hear from you about how we can be a blessing to you as a church, how we can serve you better as men. And so please come and join us for that. It'll be a great time to be together Saturday morning, 7 a.m. And then also, as you leave today, we'd love you to sign up for Family Camp. Eric Nelson will be out there. He'll be taking signups. So please, if you're planning on joining us for Family Camp in August at Triangle Lake, please make sure you're catching Eric on your way out today. All right, I want to invite the worship team to come forward. I want to invite the rest of you to stand with us. We're going to begin our morning by singing praises to our Maker.
We've been in a series on the Sermon on the Mount. If you came in, if you got a bulletin, a worship folder, something that looked like one of these, it has some notes in it that you can follow along with. And as we look at the Sermon on the Mount, we're just about halfway through chapter 5. As we continue in this, we'll continue up close to Advent. Sometime around Thanksgiving, we'll be finishing up through chapter 7. It's important that we know right at the top of your notes, it has kind of a little theme there that we've been following through, and that is that Jesus is not setting up a new law. He is countering oral traditions that drew the line of obedience at external conformity. In his kingdom, the heart is the source of life. And what Christ does is he renews our hearts. I like watching all kinds of sports, all kinds of stuff on TV. The problem is, as I watch it, I tend to enter into a little bit about what's going on. So when I watch a tennis match, I'm starting to think that the guy who is hitting these killer shots to impossible angles on the court from the baseline, these winners, Novak Djokovic, I think, that's me. That's me. And you know, and you start to see him going for it, and maybe my arm will twitch. Maybe I'll think, you know what? I think I got a can of balls somewhere in the garage. And I've got a tennis racket. I just see something played at the highest level. And I think, I need to do that more. I watch on YouTube regularly. It comes up and it's athletics. It's track and field. And it's track and field at the highest level. So I never want to just see somebody running a really good race. I'm looking when it says a new world record. And it doesn't matter if it's somebody like Sydney McLaughlin who's been tearing up the track in the 400 meter women's hurdles. I'm like, I bet I could get over a hurdle or run through it or do something. I watch track and field athletics and I start to think, yeah, I should jog some. You know, I should do that. And it's not limited just to athletics. One of my favorite movies is Life is Beautiful. And Life is Beautiful, when you watch that, either you watch it in Italian with the dubbed English subtitles. We always watch it in English. But after I watch that, and it's got these Italian actors in it, it's impossible for me, and not after watching the movie, just for a little bit, I started talking like this, and I started saying, you know, we should have go to Italy, and we should have do this. And it'd be great, and we could have go play that, you know? And then my kids will say, we watch one movie, and he's talking in a fake Italian accent for 2 days. Now, when you read the Sermon on the Mount, what we are seeing is we are seeing God's kingdom portrayed at the highest level for human flourishing, for what it means to be fully human, what it means to be aligned with the kingdom of God, what it means for His purposes to flow through our lives. And we realize that in that, when we read about the mournful and the meek and the peacemakers and the persecuted and the pure in heart, we read those blessings and we should go, yeah, I want some of that blessing in my life. And we read earlier in chapter 5 where he's talking about murder and how deadly murder is and how we should not murder. And then he says, you know what? It's way beyond murder. It's about anger. People who are angry with one another. And there's contempt. And there's the calling of people a name, or a fool because of their position. And Jesus says, that's not the way it is in my kingdom. And we should read that and we should go, yeah, that's the world I want to live in, where people don't character assassinate one another for something like an ill-advised post on social media, where people are able to look across at one another of very different persuasions and are able to say that there's still a love for the image of God in that person that requires me to respect that. And I go, yeah, that's the world I want to live in. And when we see that, just as sure as when you see an athletic endeavor or a musical concert or something played out online or on the TV, and you think, yeah, I want to be that. I want to start playing air guitar because I just watched a really good concert. It's like you should read the Sermon on the Mount and you say, that's the Savior that I want. That's the life that I want. That's the kingdom that I want to live in, where those values from the King come to His people, and they are emulated by people coming together and saying, if He would only do that in our life, if He would only take care of the anger in our life, if He would only take care of these things that are so broken, as we sung, and we know He is one day, but right now we look at that and we say, that's the King and the kingdom that I want to be a part in. So if you turn to Matthew chapter 5, verse 27, or follow along on your device or in your notes, Jesus is going to say in Matthew 5, 27, you have heard that it was said, do not commit adultery. Now, that is sex outside of marriage with somebody who is married to somebody else. Jesus says, don't do that. That's written right in the law. It's in Exodus chapter 20. It's in Deuteronomy chapter 5. So far, we say, yeah, that would be a really good thing. That would help a lot of marriages to stay intact. It would put people and families in a thing, because the hurt that comes out of that is so incredibly hurtful and painful. None of us want to do that, right? So let's just agree that's the King and the kingdom we want to live in. Now, we're not there, but we want to get there. And we watch that, we hear that, and we say, yeah. Well, then he goes on. But I tell you, he says, Now, the authority that Jesus has as a king, the very end of the Sermon on the Mount, in Matthew chapter 7, the last two verses, it says, when Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds were amazed at his teaching. Why? Because he taught as one who had authority. Because he's speaking into their lives. He's not just repeating stuff that others have said. He's saying, this is what God's will looks like and hears like through me. And Jesus Christ speaks as the perfect Son of God, the representative of God on earth. And he's going, now I'm going to tell you something. You've heard it said, don't commit adultery. But I'm going to tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. And you have to say, boy. Either Jesus has just upped the ante and he's out Moses. You know, he's gone beyond Moses and he's saying, this is just going to go way beyond that. Or he's saying there's something fundamentally different in his kingdom, which goes beyond mere external conformity to the law. I can say I have never in Exodus 20, Deuteronomy 5, committed adultery. Never slept with somebody else's wife. Jesus says, that's kind of like, it's not a minimum bar, but That's a law of something that Moses had, but Jesus says, let me talk about the new covenant relationship that I want to have with the people in the kingdom of God as I see it. He goes, it's a kingdom where there is not even the lustful look between men and women. He talks about that as lustful intent. Or purposeful. It's not just seeing somebody beautiful walk by and go, that's a really beautiful human being. Whether it's a guy, and I mean, watch movies with somebody and go, well, that actor is really a hot actor. You're going to go, lustful. The idea is there an intent? Is there a purpose behind it? Is it the pause and rewind that keeps playing the obsessive fantasy over and over and over again in your head with the idea of fulfilling that for selfish satisfaction? That, Jesus says, is equated with adultery. So to look at a woman with a lustful intent to objectify women or to objectify men, to say that that person, as much as they are in the image of God and deserve all the respect and all the love and all the consideration I could give them, you say, nah, that's just something that I want for me. Jesus says, in his kingdom, that doesn't work. Now, it's going to go on. He's going to say in verse 29, if your right eye causes you to sin, gouge it out and throw it away. It's better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. For it is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into the hell. When he says gouge out the offending eye, that is maybe equated with the idea of coveting. He's saying do not covet. In fact, in the commandment against coveting, it says do not covet your neighbor's wife. That would be very similar to that. Don't covet. He says, cut off the offending hand. In other words, do not steal. That would be in Exodus verse 20, verse 15. If the eye leads you to covet, he says, get rid of that. If the hand is leading you to steal, to take something which does not belong to you, then he says, cut off the offending hand. Now, that's one of the hard sayings of Jesus. There's got to be a place in which we realize, hopefully, that it's not really about poking your eye out or cutting off your hand. There's a short joke I'm going to tell you. Just because I like jokes and I think this may or may not fit. If it doesn't fit, you can talk to me later, write a letter to the elders. It was down south, because all the good jokes happen down south. So down south somewhere, a preacher's preaching away, and there's a balcony like we have up there. And somebody's leaning over the balcony and got hot in the balcony, and somebody got, they fainted. And as they fainted over the balcony, they got caught, their clothing got caught on a hook. Well, so far, not too bad. The problem was the person who fainted was the local Miss Peach Blossom. And when she fainted and her clothing got caught on the hook of the balcony, it pulled her dress up over her head, and she's hanging by her dress over the edge of the balcony. The pastor is the only one who can see what's really happened, and right away, he warns all the men in the church, do not turn around and look at that young lady in her distress, in her disadvantage, because if you do, here it comes, God will strike you blind. One elderly deacon in the front row turns to the guy next to him and elbows him and says, you know, Clem, he says, I think I'm going to risk just one eye. Now, when Jesus says, gouge out your eye, cut off your hand, he's realizing that that's really not the issue. So what this one author says, Dallas Willard, he says the Pharisees' view, the law could be satisfied and goodness attained if you avoided sinning. You are right if you've done nothing wrong. You could avoid sinning if you simply eliminated the bodily parts that made sinful actions possible. Then you would roll into heaven a mutilated stump. The mutilated stump could still have a wicked heart. The deeper question always concerns who you are, not what you did do or can do. What would you do if you could? Eliminating bodily parts will not change that. If you dismember your body to the point where you could never murder or even look hatefully at another, never commit adultery or even look to lust, your heart could still be full of anger, contempt, and obsessive desire for what was wrong, no matter how thoroughly stifled or suppressed it may be. The goodness of the kingdom heart, by contrast, is the positive love of God and those around us that fills it and crowds out the many forms of evil. From that goodness come deeds of respect and purity that characterize a sexuality as it was meant by God to be. You see what he's saying? The Pharisees' view was like, we will just toe the line. And yet if it was the idea that Jesus is saying, you know what, get rid of the bodily parts, he's pointing that out, that there's no amount of self-mutilation. That guy, when he says you could roll into heaven a mutilated stump, I just see these people with no arms, no legs. In fact, in Matthew 18, it even expands. It says, if your foot offends you, cut your foot off. No hands, no feet, no eyes, and still a rotten heart that desires to do wrong if it can. Jesus says, when he changes the heart, he fills you with new desires. He does that in such a way that it transforms not only your life, but the lives of you, people around you. In fact, it would change the entire community in which we live. If God so changed our hearts through the salvation of Jesus by the power of the Spirit, that you had good and godly desires, and you read Jesus saying that in the Sermon on the Mount, and you either go, ha, that's impossible, we're going to have a church full of eye patches and stumps and nothing left. Or you say, yeah, it is impossible. So we need Jesus and his Spirit to continue to change our hearts. He goes on and talks about that. He's going to talk in verse 31. He talks about divorce. It has been said, anyone who divorces his wife must give her a certificate of divorce. That's a quote in Deuteronomy 24. We read that Moses had permitted the divorce, and if a husband divorced his wife, he was to give her a certificate. Otherwise, she would not have any legal standing and could be accused of adultery if she married another man. And that would be a death sentence for her under Leviticus chapter 20. Moses made a concession, Jesus says, for hard hearts. In Matthew 19:8, you can read that. He made a concession for hard hearts. You may know the term atherosclerosis, hardening of the arteries. The Greek word for a hard heart is sclerocardia. It's literally, it's just where we get the word hard heart, just like a hardening of the arteries. Moses made a concession for hard hearts. I've talked to somebody, and they have told me, you know why my wife and I decided to get a divorce? It was because my heart's hard. And I should have said at the time, and I didn't, because I just learned this. It just came as like, you can't claim hardness of heart as a reason to divorce as a believer. Because under Moses, he said that, and Jesus came to renew hearts. In fact, in Ezekiel 36, he goes, I'm going to take out your heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh. And under the new covenant, there's this understanding that what has happened and what has transpired is God is giving you the desire to live differently than Moses ever did and ever conceived of under the law. In your notes, there's a little square there. It's noted and it says anger. Jesus talked about anger under the commandment of don't murder. And he talked about contempt. And now he's talking about, just recently talked about, obsessive lust will infect and poison even the best relationships, including a good marriage. You see, as Jesus put together this sermon, he talks about who's blessed in the kingdom. He talks about what the relationship of the law was. It talks about his relationship to fulfill that law. And now he goes on and he says, you know what? Because of this, even if you're into this obsessive lust and desire, that's not going to be good for you because it's going to take you in a way which is going to destroy the relationships that you're in. Verse 32, he says, but I say to you, anyone who divorces his wife except for marital unfaithfulness causes her to become an adulteress, and anyone who marries the divorced woman commits adultery. In that saying, where Jesus says, again, I say unto you, he says, no divorce as it was practiced, with one exception. The exception clause in Matthew is repeated in Matthew 19. There have been books written about this. There are hundreds of articles written about the grammar, the language, what Moses has said, what Jesus has said. One option you may have read is that what's called sometimes the betrothal option, and that is that the only type of sexual unfaithfulness that Matthew had in mind was the sort where Joseph made a mental decision that he was going to divorce Mary before they were married. I don't believe that is the most convincing to me of the interpretations. I believe it's an exception that is related there in your notes. The word is porneia, and it has a broad meaning that is any type of sexual unfaithfulness, including adultery, incest, homosexuality, prostitution, etc. So when divorce is permitted, not required, when a divorce is permitted, reconciliation is the biblical ideal. If the divorce is biblically allowed, then remarriage is also allowed. And the Christian community must be the safest place for struggling marriages to heal. That's underlined, if it could be bold, if it could be circled, if it could be highlighted. Because there is not a single marriage in the church that does not struggle at some point. And if the only way for people in a struggling marriage to get help is to say, I have to leave church, or I have to go somewhere else, or I have to just be gone for a while, I need to work on something, then we've not done our job in understanding that what Jesus does is he encourages and welcomes a community of people who say, yeah, my marriage struggles. Your marriage struggle? How does that work in terms of the community of faithful? And how do we go towards God's ideal? When we hear this saying, we need to wonder more, not work harder. We need to wonder more, not work harder. What do I mean by that? To wonder is to say, geez, I don't know how we're going to do that. The words that he just said about the importance of purity in your thinking, the words that he just said about the permanence of marriage, you look at that and you think, gee, that's amazing. I don't know how we get there. It's got to be that drives us to the gospel. There's a book that we're reading as a church. I've just finished it. Some of you have read it. We're going to have a discussion about it at the end of the month. I had a good discussion this morning about some questions about it. Somebody has it's called Gay Girl, Good God. It's about a lady named Jackie Hill Perry who came out of a lesbian relationship and was miraculously saved by Jesus, brought into him. She talks about how is it that God would provide a way for me to walk freely as a believer, and how that not be in the gospel. In other words, where else could you find the way to walk if it wasn't in the gospel? I need to assume that the gospel was not only an introduction to Jesus, the first step, but it was what she needed to live in. I needed to cling to, meditate on, trust in, believe always this gospel daily with the same kind of unhindered desperation that led me to it in the first time. In being anchored in this gospel, I would be holding on to God. You see, the option of being anchored in the gospel and God's grace that we sang about earlier and what it means to embrace Him and what He has for life and how we live on and how we go forward. The option, opposite of that, is just to say, I just got to work harder. You know, I just got to be a better me. I got to, you know, pull on my big boy Christian pants and go for it, you know. And if I can just sin less, God will be pleased more. And that's what somebody has termed the gospel of sin management. In other words, you just manage your life. The gospel says you can't manage your life. You can't live up to the standards that God has for your life. You can't find the full and free forgiveness for any and all sin unless you just come to Jesus the first time and you keep coming and you keep coming and you keep coming. What Jesus has taught here, His teaching flows from who He is. His teaching flows from who He is. Jesus is the one who treated women with an amazing respect. You read through the Gospels and it's everybody from the woman at the well, the women who were last at the cross and first at the empty tomb. It's the woman who begged Jesus to heal her daughter who was suffering from demon possession, and Jesus dismissed her. And then he says later, the lady says, yeah, but even the dogs get the crumbs under the table. And Jesus goes, you got amazing faith. I'll do it for you. It's the humility of that. It's Jesus raising the widow of Cain's son. It's Jesus hanging out with Mary and Martha and the prominence they had. His respect for women was unparalleled. Not only in that century, but even in today's world. And it's Jesus being faithful to those that He has chosen, that is faithful to His church. So in Ephesians chapter 5, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave Himself up for her. It's verse 29. After all, no one ever hated his body. He feeds and cares for it, just as Christ does the church. Verse 32, this is a profound mystery, but I'm talking about Christ and the church. As we continue to go through the Sermon on the Mount, and as we continue to see what Jesus says, you've heard it said, but I say to you, we just go back and we have to have one of two responses. Either we throw our hands up and go, that is an impossible ideal, or we see somebody who's giving a teaching and he's living a life, and we say, I want that. I want that world that he describes, and I want it by his grace, his salvation, what he's done in our life.